Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, as always, if you want to call in or be on the show, the number is 267-521-0159. You can add your 2 cents worth to what we're talking about. You know, one of the things that sets this country apart from others is justice, allegedly. We're supposed to have a system that gives everyone due process, equal protection for everybody. Well, I've learned firsthand that's not true. I found out today that even judges play games. And when it's your interest at stake and you discover that the judge has played fast and loose with the rules because he likes the other side, that does raise interesting questions. Now, I've got a judge that is just so opposed to me, he can't see straight because I'm not an anointed attorney. So he has literally ignored everything I've submitted. The other side asked for a hearing. They get it immediately. I got things pending since April. When I raise an issue, I'm told to hush and sit down. Because I'm just a dumb old pro se. I don't know any different. Well, I hate to burst the judge's bubble. In my misspent youth, I went to law school. And until I met some even crookeder judges, I was happy practicing. Until I saw them with their hand in the cookie jar, and I said, "What are you doing?" And I was told I needed to get on board and understand how the world worked. And I should have. But at the end of the day, we all have to look at ourselves in the mirror. So I said, I can't do it. I took their money. I gave my word. Well, you'll pay for it. And they're right. They destroyed my career. And they have done everything they can to continue doing that for, 30 years? Well, I've discovered some other interesting things. You know, I write books these days in addition to doing this show. And we're getting ready to start doing a TV version. Where we're going to talk about what's right. Now, we all know about Watergate. We all know Richard Nixon was just the worst person ever come down the road. Because they had all this evidence showing that he'd violated the law. Well, I read a book a day, and I have since I was old enough to carry one. And I came across an interesting book about the Watergate evidence. And the author was clearly chuckling to himself as he wrote it about the fact that, you know, the judge was a good friend of the prosecutor, and well, he wanted his name known for future generations. So what's more guaranteed to do that than bringing down the president of the United States? And after all, Richard Nixon was just a dirty Republican. We didn't need any of those. Need to get a good Democrat in there. Now, if you want to see how good Democrats are treated when they don't toe party line, look at the Kennedy assassination. Now, a lot of folks I know weren't even alive when Kennedy was assassinated. I was 10. I remember it like it was yesterday. When I was doing my show, I started in California. And I had a guy call, and he said, look, I was a contract CIA agent. Apparently, and I knew from government service that the CIA had a lot of people on contract who were not employees, kind of independent contractors. And he said he was called in to clean up situations. And there was a guy in Boston who was preaching violence against blacks. And he knew something about the Kennedy assassination he shouldn't know. So he wanted the guy that was calling me to go check it out. So he went. He found the guy, talked to him, got his story. The guy that he went to meet turned out to be gay, which is important only because one of his lovers was a Marine named Lee Harvey Oswald. And according to the story, this guy took the guy he'd gone to see to the airport the day Oswald was returning from Russia with his new bride and his baby. Just curious to see if Oswald would recognize him. And when Oswald came to the terminal, this guy stepped up and said, hello, Lee. And he had no idea who he was. And after the meeting was over, the one the agent took said, look, he's a spitting image, but that's not the Lee Harvey Oswald I knew. Well, this guy, at my request, tape recorded his entire story and sent it to me. And I've kept it all this time. I found it the other day. And a lot of information I could independently verify. Now, it turns out that there's a lot about Lee Harvey Oswald that's never been bandied about. And I'm doing a series of books. I'm calling them the Assassination Files. But I discovered that there is an organization started by William Donovan. Wild Bill Donovan, head of the OSS. Well, after the war, when Truman disbanded the OSS, everyone thought that Donovan just went home and happily wrote his memoirs. That wasn't true. Apparently, there was a group of very wealthy people who operate from the shadows, and they have a plan for this country. And anybody who deviates from that plan is removed, or they lose their job, or you know, something else happens to them. And one of the people was John Kennedy. Now, very few people know that Kennedy, probably because of his service in World War II, was not exactly pro-war. And he was not going to continue the incursion in Vietnam. In fact, he was phasing things out when he was assassinated. Now, a lot of these people who operate from the shadows make billions of dollars as government contractors during wartime. So it's to their benefit for the wars to continue. Why do you think we've had a war going on somewhere since the 60s? Now, the attack on our ship that led to, that kicked off the Vietnam War, that because of that, Congress gave Johnson all the power he wanted to wage war. Turns out, didn't happen. It was fake. Now, the same people involved in that were involved in the proposal to John Kennedy, what they called Operation Northwood. They said that, in fact, the Joint Chiefs made the proposal that we shoot down our own planes, we kill our own troops, we attack our own cities, and blame whoever it is we want to go to war against. And Kennedy said no. Well, after his assassination, Johnson gave it the green light. But out of curiosity, I started digging into a lot of records I had access to prior to 1963 and discovered we had done something similar all the way back to the colonial days. You know, many of the wars we have fought, we started, to include the what's referred to as the Texas Revolution. We goaded Santa Anna until he sent troops north. Now, that doesn't make him right. But neither was he a total bad guy. We had a lot to do with it. The president at the time marched troops up and down the border until Santa Anna was afraid we were going to come across and take Texas. Because that was the plan, to take Texas. Now, John Kennedy was not an altar boy. He had a lot of issues to be laid at his doorstep. But there was no justification for shooting him. And of course, you know, the according to Hoover, the FBI single-handedly discovered Oswald. And that's great for public consumption. But anybody who manages to delve into the story quickly discovers there's a lot of problems with the theory that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone nut gunman. See, this is the only country where if there's an assassination, there's never a conspiracy involved. It's always a lone nut gunman. Always. But if you start looking, there's more to the story. As Paul Harvey used to say. Now, the tape that I gave, or that I got, and that I'm incorporating into the assassination files, made it very clear that Oswald was at a minimum only one shooter. And he wasn't that great a shot, and the weapon he had was Italian surplus, and it was a piece of crap to start with. And nobody in their right mind would try to shoot quickly with that bolt-action rifle. The mechanics just wouldn't work. Now, if you want to call in and get involved in discussion, 267-521-0159, this is the Ken Hudnall Show. Well, it turns out that there was a witness to the assassination whose name has never hit the light of day. His name was Ed Hoffman. And he had taken a day off from work to go to the dentist, and the trip from his house to the dentist took him past Dealey Plaza. And he stopped when he realized that the president's motorcade is going to pass by just any moment. And he stood on one of the railroad overpass, and he watched two men, one in a dark business suit, a hat and a tie, and the other dressed in a cap and overalls of a railroad worker. They were behind the wooden fence on the grassy knoll. And as Hoffman watched, when the president got there, they shot him. And then the man in the coat and tie took off running, and the man dressed as a railroad worker disassembled the weapon and put it in a bag and ran off himself. Now, you would think that if Hoffman witnessed this, that would have made the Warren Commission's job so much easier. But you see, Hoffman was a deaf mute. And in those days, there were no certified sign language translators. That didn't happen until over 10 years later. And everybody he went to and tried to tell his story, they dismissed him as an idiot because he couldn't talk. His own father said, "Don't get involved. They'll come after you next." His uncle, who was a police officer, Hoffman had to depend on his father to translate to his uncle. And he believes his father lied to protect his son. Now, the problem with the story the Warren Commission told, they even looked at Oswald's high school records. Now, what does that have to do with whether or not he pulled the trigger? Additionally, all those high-minded people and attorneys, and none of them were criminal investigators. They depended on the FBI and the CIA to give them the information they needed to arrive at their conclusion. Well, what if the FBI and CIA agents had their own agenda? There was one member of the Warren Committee, or Warren Commission, rather, who didn't agree with the roughshod Hoover was so determined that it was going to show one assassin that he was blackmailing the members of the commission. Well, one of them objected. And when the magic bullet theory came to light, you see, one of the pieces of evidence that there was more than one shooter, well, there were seven wounds. That just wasn't possible with one shooter. Well, Les Aspin, who later on became Secretary of the Army, head of the Armed Services Committee, came up with the magic bullet theory. The bullet kept ricocheting off bones, so it did all the damage and then hit Governor Connally. And then as Connally lay on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital, it fell out of his wound to be found. Pristine. Every time a bullet hits something, it leaves something behind. And the congressman who did not agree with Hoover went to Alaska to campaign for a candidate there. And while flying to one of the campaign stops, the plane disappeared, vanished, hadn't been found to this day. Now, everybody who was a member of the commission got a reward. Gerald Ford, who was not the sharpest knife in the drawer by any means, became president. Had he not sat on the Warren Commission, nobody would know who he was, except those in his own district. Now, Jack Ruby was interviewed by Earl Warren. That was the Warren Commissioner, remember? He was Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court at the time. Ruby said, look, I can't tell you here, everybody who was involved, but if you'll take me to Washington, I will give you names and everything you need to solve this case. And Warren said, nope, can't do it. Well, Ruby died of cancer in jail. When he went to trial, his trial was pleading guilty, which meant no trial, no investigation. Turns out that his attorney did not follow his instructions. He wanted to plead not guilty, and the attorney said he was guilty. Oh, the more you dig into it, the dirtier it gets. Now, we've seen in the Russia hoax just how trustworthy the FBI has become. Well, it turns out during the Kennedy assassination, the FBI pulled their guns on the Dallas police to assist the Secret Service and taking the president's body out of Parkland Hospital before an autopsy could be done. See, at the time, shooting the president was not a federal crime. It was a state crime. And it should have been investigated and prosecuted as a state crime. But Hoover wasn't going to let that happen. Any evidence that tended to show that it wasn't a lone gunman was suppressed by FBI agents. And if it managed to get to the commission, more often than not, they refused to hear the testimony. Now, one of the big pieces of evidence that tended to show it was a lone shooter in the Texas School Book Depository was the fact that the doctors who did the examination at Parkland said the president was shot from the rear. Now, when you're shot, it's a small hole going in, especially a high-powered rifle, and a bigger hole coming out. And they said, well, the throat wound was big. So that means that the bullet went in the back of the skull and then came out the throat. Well, according to a doctor, he was actually a resident at the time, when he first walked into, on the day of the assassination, he was a fourth-year medical student at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. And he was standing by in the emergency room as the president was brought in. And he was there continuously from the moment Kennedy got there until well after medical efforts to revive him were abandoned. And he said it was a small, round hole about the size of the one you would cut for a tracheotomy. And the two surgeons who actually worked on the president made it a point, though there was no necessity to do so, to slice that round hole so it appeared to be a slit. Then when the body got to Bethesda, there was a general standing in the corner where nobody could see him, giving instructions to the doctors, the pathologists who were examining the president. And according to all the x-rays of the brain have disappeared over the years. And Johnson ordered all records relating to the assassination to be sealed until 2038, which led a lot of people to believe Johnson was involved. And according to the tape that I have, and the gentleman that made the tape, one reason he started talking was somebody tried to assassinate him. That does tend to annoy folks. And the, the police, when a police officer gets a call over the police radio, they assume it's legitimate because who else is going to be on the police band? Well, the story of Oswald shooting Kennedy and then going home and shooting J.D. Tippit on the way, and then leaving and going to the movies, has always struck me as a little odd. Well, in a city of, at that time, over 500,000 people, for the police to actually find the man they're looking for in just a few hours is nothing short of a miracle. What happened is they got a police call that the president's assassin had snuck into a movie theater. Now, that was not the call that was made to the police headquarters. The manager of the movie theater called and said a man had gone in without buying a ticket. Now, you've got the president of the United States just shot, you got a police officer shot, and you're going to take time to go see about a man who went into a movie without a ticket? Well, the call that came out on the police band that the officers responded to was the president's assassin is in the movie theater. Well, when the police came running in, Oswald jumped to his feet. He had a pistol in his waistband. He pulled it out and he pulled the trigger. Turned out later that the pistol did not have a firing pin. Either A, Oswald wanted to commit a suicide by police. B, somebody gave him a gun and didn't want him to survive to tell his story. Or C, he took the gun apart to clean it and didn't put it back together properly. Nothing else makes any sense. But the long and the short of it is, instead of shooting Oswald as they should have, they overwhelmed him and they arrested him. And they took him to police headquarters, where a Dallas police captain was questioning him. Now, in the room also was an FBI agent by the name of Hostie. And normally, when you're questioning somebody, as I'm sure you've seen on all the police shows, One person does the talking. Well, Hosty continued to interrupt and just made the interrogation a total disaster. And then the FBI tried to confiscate all the evidence the Dallas police had collected that Oswald had actually been the shooter. Well, they were going to transfer him from police headquarters, what should have been one of the most heavily guarded buildings in Dallas at the time, to the jail. And as they walked him through the basement, Jack Ruby steps out of the crowd and shoots Oswald twice. Now, according to medical folks I've talked to, the wounds that Oswald suffered should not have been fatal if he got quick medical care. But he died, which makes it awful difficult for him to be questioned. It also raises questions. He's taken to Parkland, which also raises some interesting questions. Now, Chief Curry of the Dallas Police Department took exception to the FBI screwing up the case and said so publicly. Well, you don't say that about one of J. Edgar Hoover's bright young men. So Hoover gave orders to take all the evidence to Washington, refused to give the Dallas police any information. Hoover claimed his agency was embarrassed and they weren't going to deal with the incompetent Dallas Police Department anymore. Turns out the FBI knew that Oswald had defected to Russia and returned. They knew he was working in Dallas in the school book depository, but they didn't tell the police. Does raise some interesting questions, I would think. Now, Curry made it clear that, yes, he was going to loan the evidence to the Dallas police, but it was the Dallas police case. So he had copies of everything made and gave to the FBI, and the FBI made it all go away. Once the FBI got the evidence in their hands, they never gave it back. Those were Hoover's orders. The FBI went in to seize evidence at the scene. Secret Service agents had taken the president's body. State law required an autopsy. Secret Service said not just no, but hell no. Now, the sad thing is, Hoover's actions almost single-handedly resulted in the case being, shall we say, prematurely ended. Now, Curry blamed the FBI for the major screw-up. Now, according to the former Times Herald police reporter George Carter, Curry was an efficient officer. And over 20 years, he'd followed his career, and he was good. He was very good. Now, it was a feud between Curry and Hoover that obscured much of what took place. Apparently, Hoover's cold war with Curry and the DPD actually took precedent over establishing the facts in the death of a president. And the ill will between the FBI and the DPD disrupted and undermined all efforts at both ends of the investigation. Battles behind the scenes dominated the attention of investigators to such an extent the whole procedure became an ineffective sham. And it's every possibility that evidence was purposely concealed or destroyed by the FBI simply to make the Dallas police look bad. Well, there were many unanswered questions that, of course, will never be answered now. There was never a chance that the killers of the president were going to be found. Never a chance. If it's not solved in the first 48 hours, something like this is not going to be solved. And because of the political shenanigans that took place, the investigation was a farce. And with the suspect dead, they could say anything they wanted, and there's nobody to say no. Now, it came out later and kind of was downplayed by the media. Now, the media, the mainstream media, dances to the tune of the Democratic Party. They have, they always will. Because a lot of the people who fund a lot of these things by advertising, that make careers, seem to be from the liberal side of the track. Now, in a number of the assassinations I've been investigating for my new series, The Assassination Files, a lot of killers have gone free because it wasn't politically expedient to have them caught. Now, that says a lot about our justice system. And a lot of people who were totally innocent have gone to prison. Either their attorneys were paid off or just flat-ass incompetent. I know a bunch of flat-ass incompetent attorneys. And if you got a crooked judge working with a crooked attorney or just an incompetent attorney, you got a total miscarriage of justice. And sometimes you have judges go wink, wink, nudge, nudge to one side or the other in a case, because a judge, as one said to me, I don't care what the law says. I don't care what the rule says. I'm the judge, and that's my decision. That's called judicial discretion. That translates as, I get more back in him than I do back in you. And we got an election coming up, and I'm going to be talking about some judges. I'm going to be talking about some attorneys who think they're going to be judges. It's time that folks quit pussyfooting around and tell the truth. Now, quite often, evidence is downplayed because it's not politically correct that it point to one person or another. That's the good old boy defense. I've seen a lot of that. One of the people that came under suspicion of the Kennedy assassination was a police officer named Roy Vaughn. Lived in Midlothian, Texas, which is a small semi-rural town south of Dallas. He died in 2010. And for roughly half that time, he was the town's police chief. All told, he spent about 50 years in law enforcement. It was described as every inch the cop. And he had a reputation for toughness and honesty and, you know, all the things that we expect from our law enforcement. Well, considering all that, it's easy to understand why Vaughn would never talk about the events of November 1963. At the time, he was an ordinary patrolman for the Dallas Police Department, and he found himself thrust into the biggest murder mystery of the century. And through no fault of his own, he found himself the subject of a controversy that continues to this day. For a single two-day period, an almost unbelievable web of intrigue tangled itself around Patrolman Vaughn. And it happened the moment the shots fired in Dealey Plaza. Well, he rushed to the scene of the assassination in time to confront a wild assortment of suspects. learned later each and every one of them been allowed to walk away. And that web expanded with suddenness soon after Jack Ruby gunned down Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement of the Dallas police headquarters. Within an hour of Oswald's shooting, Vaughn found himself facing the accusation he'd assisted Ruby in the commission of his crime by allowing him entry to the basement. So within the space of 48 hours, he went from pursuing subjects to being, in essence, a suspect himself. Now, he was exonerated, fully and officially. But speculation continues to this day. Now, he talked about what happened in January of 1993. First time he ever talked about it. But by then, he had seen firsthand how the insidious web of suspicion can drag people down. He watched it obsess and destroy one of his closest friends. Now, the day that Kennedy came to Dallas, Vaughn had been a member of the police department for a little over 5 years. He was sworn in as a 23-year-old rookie cop a few months after completing a 4-year hitch in the Navy. Spent most of that time assigned to a patrol district in the Fair Park area of South Dallas. Seconds after the shots were fired in Dealey Plaza, his patrol unit was among a flood of police cars that converged on the plaza from all directions. They said they only had one radio frequency at the time, and the dispatcher told all squads in the vicinity of downtown to head for the triple underpass, Code 3. Parked his car beside the Texas School Book Depository and his first order to take up a position between the depository and the Dow Tex building and stand guard. Didn't know what he was guarding, but he stood guard. Well, while he was standing there, he came face to face with the first of several suspicious characters. Security guard brought a man out of the Dow Tex building and led him over to him, said he found him on an upper floor of the building where he had no business to be, and he couldn't explain what he was doing there. And he said the man was very well dressed, had a narrow-brimmed derby hat and expensive clothes. Asked him to show some ID, and he pulled out a billfold, he said, with more credit cards in it than he'd ever seen. Ordinary people didn't carry credit cards in those days. This guy had a dozen or more. Glanced at the ID and turned him over to some officers to take to the sheriff's office. He got released about 5 minutes later. Nobody had the slightest idea who he was or why he was there. And everybody wanted to get the assassin. Not long after the security guard brought out the guy in the derby, somebody came running out of the railroad yard and said he had reported 3 or 4 men jumping into a boxcar down under the Houston Street Viaduct. That was a long way, but 5 or 6 of them, the police ran down there, and the guy pointed out the boxcar. Vaughn said he climbed up a ladder on the side of the car and looked down inside, and there were 3 guys there. He pulled his pistol and ordered them out. Now, Vaughn had no way of knowing it, but the 3 guys he caught became some of the most celebrated and controversial figures to ever emerge from 50 years of assassination research. That patrolman had just arrested the legendary 3 tramps, whose identities have never been fully established, but who have been alleged at various times to include the Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt, convicted hitman Charles Harrelson, that's Woody Harrelson's father, by the way, and other shady characters. Now, for many years, it was believed that all 3 of the tramps were released that day without ever being questioned about their identities determined. But forms supposedly bearing the name of the men turned up in late 1991 among some unknown Dallas Police Department files. Researchers have questioned whether the names are accurate, but Vaughn said he had no reason to believe otherwise. The odd part, in his judgment, was that the three men were taken all the way to the police headquarters, which was 6 or 7 blocks away. Now, the vast majority of witnesses, suspicious people, and others questioned by authorities that day were taken to the sheriff's office, which was in the criminal courts building, overlooking Dealey Plaza and much more convenient for interrogations. Records unearthed in 1991 identified the three tramps as Gus Abrams, Harold Doyle, and John Forster Getty. And it listed the arresting officer as W.S. Chambers. So somebody falsified some documents. He said the three tramps were noticeably different in appearance from the usual hobos and derelicts that frequented the railroad yards. The guys in the boxcar weren't filthy or dirty like most of the bums you see. Clothes were reasonably clean, although they weren't clean-shaven. They didn't have heavy gloves or beard. No evidence they'd been drinking. They were definitely not running the real mill winos. Well, asked if he believed these men had something to do with the assassination of the president, he frowned and shook his head and said, "I just don't know." One of the oddest aspects of the police presence in Dealey Plaza during that first 15 minutes to half hour after the shots were fired that none of the dozens of officers present went inside any of the surrounding buildings from which snipers could have fired at the motorcade. 25 to 30 sheriff's deputies were watching the presidential procession from the sidewalk outside the criminal courts building. They immediately fanned out over the area to question the witnesses and look for evidence. Within minutes, they were joined by squads of Dallas police who came from scattered parts around the city. But even with all those officers present, the investigation was not thorough by any means. And another interesting thing, when they did find the so-called sniper's nest, the three rounds were lying side by side, evenly spaced on the floor. Some say on the windowsill, others say on the floor. But all agree that they were side by side and evenly spaced apart. If you've ever fired a bolt-action rifle, that doesn't happen. Now, another deputy sheriff named Roger Craig, who was a friend of Vaughn, managed to get up to the 6th floor of the school book depository. He found the sniper's nest. Now, Vaughn said he didn't know he was there, even though they were there at the same time. Craig made some claims during the investigation and they were considered controversial. He died violently in 1974. Now, it was a Texas theater where Oswald was taken into custody. Now, the officers in Dealey Plaza immediately left when they got word that a suspect in a shooting of a patrolman had been spotted in Oak Cliff. Vaughn said there was a lot of disorganization, chaos, and the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing. Now, on Sunday, November 24th, 1963, Vaughn and a group of officers who were called away from their regular assignments and told to report to police headquarters to assist in a transfer of Oswald from the county, city jail to the larger, more secure county jail. Everyone was afraid Dallas citizens are going to try to take revenge on Oswald somewhere along that 6-block route between the two jails. Now, the feeling among the officers were the risk to Oswald wouldn't begin till he was outside the police station. Nobody thought for a minute he'd be in any danger as long as he was inside. Now, by the time Vaughn got to the station, crowds of reporters, photographers, and cameramen were already assembled in the basement. And nobody knew when the precise moment when it would happen. The transfer, that is. Now, Vaughn remembers hearing a radio newscast the night before speculating the transfer would take place about 10 o'clock in the morning. And that wasn't good. It should have been done secretly. As it was a circus atmosphere. It was determined early on that guards should be posted at the tops of the two main vehicle ramps through which the official vehicles entered and exited the basement garage. Shortly before 9, Vaughn was assigned a position at the upper end of the Main Street ramp and instructed not to allow anybody to enter the basement unless that person was on official business and showed proper identification. And Vaughn remembered turning away a number of people during the next 2.5 hours. Only allowed 2 or 3 others into the basement. He said the first person he let in was a driver's license officer from the Texas Department of Public Safety. He had an appointment in the building. Another was a mechanic at the police department central garage. He said he'd been called in to assist with parking. As it turned out, it was a departing car rather than somebody trying to enter the basement that caused all the trouble. At one point during Vaughn's time there, Sergeant Patrick Dean, who was in charge of overall security in the basement, came up the ramp and told Vaughn that an armored truck was going to be brought in for the transfer. The truck was going to be used as a decoy to distract anyone with the intent to harm Oswald, while the accused assassin was actually taken out by a different route in an unmarked police car. Well, nobody checked the height of the armored car. Wouldn't clear some air conditioning duct work above Main Street. So it'll be brought in by way of the Commerce Street ramp, normally used only for exiting traffic. And even on the Commerce Street side, that truck had to back down the ramp and left in such a position where the vehicle could get through that way. That meant any cars leaving the basement prior to the transfer would have to come out via the Main Street ramp. Well, shortly before 11:20, an unmarked police car with 3 officers inside came up the Main Street ramp. Vaughn stepped off the curb to check the traffic and then signaled the driver that the roadway was clear. Now, nobody seems to know what that purpose of that car leaving was. It had 3 officers in it. 2 minutes later, someone in the basement shouted, "Here he comes." Meanwhile, despite the tedious wait, nothing was ready for Oswald's arrival. The car in which he was to ride was out of position and blocked off by police and media people who weren't where they were supposed to be. Chief Curry had not come down to personally check on the arrangements. Now, there was no shortage of police manpower. Crowded into the basement were 70 detectives and several supervisors, including a deputy chief and an assistant chief. You'd think 70 police were enough to guard against somebody shooting Oswald. But there was no protective cordon of officers around him as he was taken to the spot where the car was supposed to be. Everything was in a total disarray. Seconds later, Vaughn heard a shot from the basement. And it's somebody old Jack. And Vaughn started down the ramp and saw a flurry of hands battling for possession of a pistol. Suddenly a figure broke out of the crowd and started up the ramp. Vaughn recognized the figure as Detective D.M. Burgess, a plainclothes Dallas police officer. Others in the crowd grabbed Burgess and pulled him back, apparently unaware of who he was. A moment later, Burgess struggled free and came on up the ramp. Vaughn asked him what was going on, and he said some reporter just shot Oswald. The reporter, of course, was Jack Ruby. Vaughn is still, at the time he gave the interview, totally baffled at the absolute confusion. Well, Ruby said later they entered the basement from the Main Street side. He didn't say he came down the ramp. He just said he came in the Main Street side. So that was enough to hang Vaughn out to dry. Vaughn was officially designated a department scapegoat. Well, somebody did let Ruby in. There's no question about that. How he got in, where he came in at, was never determined. So, as you can see, this was not a well-oiled, well-organized investigation by any means. And in addition to the Kennedy assassination, there have been a number of other assassinations that have taken place anytime anyone appeared to raise up that was going to affect the path laid out by those who consider themselves our betters. And in this new series, I'm going to be naming names, because I've investigated for years. Some of those same people I stumbled across. Some of those same people right now are after President Trump. But these people always operate from the shadows. If somebody goes down, it's one of the minions. It's not them. Well, I think it's time those people had to face the light of day, so to speak. Now, the a number of people had their careers destroyed in this investigation to protect the their betters. Now, there's a lot of people who believe J. Edgar Hoover was involved. Certainly, that could have been. Jack Ruby offered to name names, but Earl Warren didn't want to hear it. Dorothy Kilgallen, now that is a mystery in and of itself. She was the only reporter to get an unsupervised interview with Ruby, went back to New York and told her publisher, "I'm blowing the roof off the Kennedy assassination. I've got the story." Next morning, she was found sitting up in bed, still wearing her makeup, dead. Now, all her notes had disappeared. She was known to have a close friend to whom she would give copies of things. That friend was found murdered, her apartment ransacked. We're going to be talking more about all this as time goes on. For right now, though, we've come to the end of tonight's show. Until tomorrow night at 6 p.m., this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.